C1SP. Number 13A.
Now we come to the fifth subject, which, as far as I see it, only contains one paragraph. Perhaps you may be of another opinion, but I don't think it matters very much if we differ perhaps on a few lines. But the subject there is very definite, a different one from the one before and the one after, and it's typically life, where the be shown what then is really the father or the creator of all the many phenomena of spiritualism. And so she deals here with the false fatherhood sense of spiritualism, where she explains that mortals evolve images of thought, and that all the apparitions which then are formed, that they appear to be things by themselves, but she explains now that all these apparitions are not things by themselves, but they are only the effect of mortal thought. So that apparitions are always evolved from mentality. That, I think, may be my epitome for this fifth, that all the apparitions in, she has quite a few of them, haunted houses, ghostly voices, unusual noises, apparitions in spiritualistic seances, and so on, that they are not things by themselves which exist by as an identity in being, see, but that they are effects of mortal thought, that mortals evolve images of thought. These may appear to the ignorant as apparitions, but they are mysterious only because it is unusual to see thoughts, though we can always feel their influence. Haunted houses, ghostly voices, unusual noises, and apparitions brought out in dark seances either involve feats of tricksters, or they are images and sounds evolved involuntarily by mortal mind. Seeing is no less a quality of physical sense and feeling. Then why is it more difficult to see a thought than to feel one? Education alone determines the difference. In reality, there is none. See, she shows that they are only pictures which are evolved from mortal thought, and usually involuntary. She uses that term, involuntary. Perhaps, if Mrs. Eddy has lived in the age of Freud and Jung and so on, she may have used the term unconsciously or subconsciously instead of involuntary. These are terms which came only, as far as I know, into common use after Mrs. Eddy's time. She wants to show, really, you see, that what so many people say when one says, well, all what these apparitions in spiritualistic seances are just mortal belief. But then they say, well, I never thought of that, what would appear. Well, that's just the point. We have to see that it is not that that involuntary mortal mind has even a bigger field than voluntary mortal mind, that the subconscious is 10 times bigger than the conscious realm of mortal mind. And so because we were not thinking of something happening, because we were not thinking that we could get ill and yet got ill, that is no disproof that everything is mental. What she explains here, science must explain here, is that these phenomena, like spiritualistic phenomena, just like sickness, have their origin in mortal mind, either in voluntary mortal mind, like an intentional mesmerism, or in involuntary, mostly in involuntary, in unconscious or subconscious mortal mind. But that does not make a difference that it is from mortal mind, no matter what we afterwards classify this mortal mind. So many things we do, each one of us, which we do and how we behave ourselves, comes from astrology. Well, we may never have read our horoscopes, and yet we can, so many things, how we act and are and how our characteristics can draw back to astrology. Mrs. Ennis says astrology is right, but it is secondary. See, she doesn't say it's humbug, but she can see that it is, that astrology is a 1,000-year-old claim that a certain position of the star is governing our character, determining our character. And until we have seen through that claim and handled that claim consciously, by seeing that the only thing that can form us and that can build us and that can give us our individuality is the divine life, until we see that, we are very much subject to astrology. And so are we subject to all sorts of ologies and isms. So alone the fact that we are not in mortal consciousness conscious of a belief does not disprove that all these evil manifestations are mental. They are mental. They are always mortally mental. Whatever is evil is have always a mortal mental origin. And that is the point which he wants to show here. And that, and the other point is that seeing and feeling are just different phases of education, that if we can feel a thought, why shouldn't we see it? So often people are feel it quite natural that if they meet somebody or go into a place or into a house, that they say, well, I could feel at once the atmosphere which was there. It was fishy. Or it was this or that. And quite naturally, they say, they believe that one can feel an atmosphere. Well, the spiritualists have been trained to see an atmosphere or to hear an atmosphere. Well, what's the difference? Feeling and seeing and hearing are all the factors, are all parts of the five physical senses. So to educate the one or the other is just a matter of education. But it isn't a proof for the reality of spiritualism. It just proves that mortal mind can be educated in many ways. But all those educations of mortal mind are always false. And so we must see this point very clearly. You see, that whatever appears as a phenomena, an unusual phenomena, an apparition, that it has always a mental origin, a mortally mental origin. Therefore, we must be it's quite clear that whatever happens, usually in spiritualistic seances, that they will always find answers and happenings which are with more or less within the realm of their own attitude. About 5 or 6 years ago, when I gave the first talk on these chapters, somebody told me if I was aware that Mrs. Eddy once said as a spirit, in a spiritualistic seance, that she was very sorry that she wrote this chapter on spiritualism. And I think either it is a lie, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a so-called spiritualistic communication. Because if in the whole world there is a sense, especially among the spiritualists, that certainly Mrs. Eddy was wrong, or she wouldn't have been attacking spiritualism. It's quite true that the whole mentality of the spiritualist must be antagonistic to Mrs. Eddy. And that naturally can bring up an answer which pleases them most. It's in mortal belief. So I wouldn't be surprised if, effectually, in a seance, that communication came through. But it's always mortals that evolve such an answer. Why should the people seek unto withers? the people and that man. Why should not the people seek unto its God? Why not the principle and let reason and revelation and science speak? Because the spiritualism is always contradictory. I know of another science of more recent date where the spirits were asked if that communication was true. That Mrs. Eddy was sorry that you wrote it. And the spirit said, oh no, oh no. Well, that's quite reasonable, you see. You ask, take it out of our own practice. I know quite a few people who 6 years ago, when I was telling them, or when they heard about Christian Science, they said, it's humbug. Oh, that's nothing, that's false, and so on. And 6 years afterwards, they come into our practice and want to accept it. The belief changes. The belief changes. You can change the belief in time and in space and in every way. Whatever the belief is, you have the apparition. The belief is always the father of itself. So we can take either one or the other. The funny thing is that at that seance, the spirit was asked if they had a special message from Mrs. Eddy's textbook, and the message was just this paragraph. It said, read this paragraph. Well, how could, if Mrs. Eddy were sorry to have ever written this textbook, and if that were a communication from truth, then exactly point out the paragraph which is exactly out of the chapter on spiritualism. You see, let's see how belief is at the ground, at the origin, at the basis of all that is spiritualistic. That we should never trust anything as real and as true which we cannot drive back, which we cannot trace back to God. If anything is traced back to a clergyman or to a medical man or to a spirit or to anything and has an origin there, it's spiritualistic. It's a human belief, it's a mortal belief, and there is no truth in it. There's no absolute truth in it. Then we come to truth, to the subject of truth. Well, after having shown, you see, that everything that goes on in the way of spiritualistic phenomena, of mental phenomena, as they have always a mental origin, that they are always evolved from mortality, as they are always evolved from mortality and from mortal thought, therefore all those original mortal thoughts are in the realm of mentality and, as he shows here, can be brought back to consciousness. Here we come to that point where he shows that not only that of which we are conscious can be brought back to consciousness, but all that bigger or wider field or realm of subconsciousness can be brought back to consciousness. The psychologist would say that through his treatment and so on, he tries to bring up from the subconscious the things into the consciousness. I think you have the subconscious and the consciousness. Here she shows that the whole subject is now concerned with making conscious the whole content of mind. That the whole content of mind, of mortal belief, and so on, can be made conscious. That we can recollect sentences, that we can take and copy and reproduce pictures of thought, that the mental environment remains always there to be discerned, to be described, and to be transmitted. That we can always recall primal facts to mortal mind, to perceive and reproduce the strong impression produced by on mortal mind by friendship or intense feeling, that memory may reproduce voices long ago silent, that forms can rise before us which are miles away or altogether gone, that we can recall the touch of a vanished hand, that we can recall the sound of a voice that is still, that we can recall even the flavor or the odor. See, here it's all about the fact that one can actually recall or recollect that which has been lost to the memory, which has been gone from this from the present consciousness, and that it can be recalled. So my epitome to this, I tried to form like this. I said these mental concepts can always be called back to consciousness. See, in life we saw that it is that apparitions and so on are always apparitions which were formed or produced by mortal mind, by mortal concept, and that we can always now go to the bottom of these apparitions, namely to the mortal concept which formed them, and bring them back to consciousness. Because that's so important in the practice. In the practice we usually only see the effects of mortal mind. We see a sick body, we hear of a pain or so, but as pain, as these apparitions are only the effects of mortal mind, are evolved by mortal mind, and mortals, we jolly well have to go to the root of these phenomena and try to bring them back to consciousness in order to destroy them. So here this truth section gives an ordered development of how thought, how thought is really at the root of everything, and how this root, even if lost to the memory, can be called back to the present consciousness. Here she says that all these mental concepts first can always be taken from pictorial thought, that portraits, landscape paintings, facsimile of penmanship, peculiarity of expression, recollected sentences, can all be taken from pictorial thought and memory. See, we come now to that point where, say, in a spiritualistic seance, the medium would, say, could write down a facsimile of penmanship, say, the signature of somebody who has passed away, exactly in the way as this person used to sign his or her name. Well, she says, from where do we get it? Do we get it from a person? Do we get it from a department? She says, no, it all can take him back from pictorial thought, because once this thought, this mental environment was established in mortal thought, and mental readers can always recall them. If they are trained to do it, they can do it better than if one isn't trained to do it. Just as we are trained, each one of us is trained to read a book, and if we have put it away and forgotten all what is in it, we can go back and read it again, because we are trained to read letters. And so mediums, and not only mediums, but also other mind readers, clairvoyants and so on, they are educated or have the susceptibility to read mortal mind. And so they reproduce what they take not from a spirit, not from a person, not from an immortal spirit, but from pictorial thought. It's always a reproduction of thought. And so she says, mortal mind sees what it believes as certainly as it believes what it sees. Well, we are educated in the material age only to believe what we see. That is our education of the last century, that we have been educated only to believe what we see. That's the materialistic age. But that was not always so. And that is certainly not everywhere so. Primitive people are not educated in that way. They are much more like children educated to see what they believe. To see what they believe. And so it's only a matter of education that we see what we believe or that we believe what we see. But the one way and the other way is just as natural or just as false. We really should only see what divine mind sees. That's the real realm. And then she shows as a second step, because that is so, because everything can be taken and recalled from thought, she says everything that has taken on a material form, like a picture on canvas, has always been taken first from thought. That the painter has always had to have first a mental concept of what he sees. And before he paints it down, he has to have a mental concept. So it says, pictures are mentally formed before the artist can convey them to canvas. So it is with all material conceptions. You see, that's what we have to see, that material things are not primal. They are secondary. The primary thing is always mortal thought, is mentality. And so the moment we begin to see, you see, the whole second part is one big shift from materiality to mentality. It's all one big shift which says to us, whatever standpoint you take, don't go out from the material. Always see that behind the material is a mental. Then, when you have seen that point, then you have to decide which mentality do you take as a reality and which mentality do you take as unreal. And so then comes the big decision that we see that only that mentality is real, which is spiritual, and that any other mentality which is not deduced from God is not real. But the big shift really is to show that we have to deal with the mental and not with the material. Well, that's the basis of Christian Science practice. That the first shift is always from the material to the mental. Then comes the point, are we spiritualists and build up the mental, or are we Christian Scientists and turn away from the mortal mental picture, mental argument, and mental suggestions, and mental hypotheses and so on, and look into the immensity of mind, and start with mind, and let that mind read the situation and uncover the error that needs to be destroyed. So here she shows everything that is material is taken from material thought, from pictorial thought, from mentality. Then she says, because it is from mentality, because mentality cannot be killed, because mentality isn't living in space or time, it can always be reproduced, can always be brought back. It can always, mind reader can copy or reproduce them, even when they are lost to the memory of the mind in which they were discoverable. Then, having said that, she goes to a fourth point and says, it is needless for the thought or for the person holding the transfer picture to be individually and consciously present. Though individuals have passed away, their mental environment remains to be discerned, described, and transmitted. Though bodies are leagues apart and their association forgotten, their associations float in the general atmosphere of the human mind. See, she gives now the fourth point, which says, and that mental atmosphere is independent of people, of the individual. Doesn't matter if that individual is present or not, if it's far away or not, if he's still living or not, it's the mental that matters. And so whatever is mental must be recalled back, and not the people, and not dependent on people. Then she goes on and says, well, that's what the Koch call second sight, when really it is the first sight instead of second, for it presents primal facts to mortal mind. See, now she says that really presents to mortal mind, primal fact, it presents the cause of every situation, the cause of a disease, the cause of a discordant situation. It presents the primal fact to mortal mind. It's the primal argument, the primal claim of mortal mind is presented. Science enables one to read the human mind, but not as a clairvoyant. It enables one to heal through mind, but not as a mesmerist. If we recall what we have seen in Principle as Truth, where Mr. Dawley showed the process, the principle of practice, there we see that through that principle of practice, we discover always the primal facts of mortal mind. It always hits that error which needs to be destroyed. It doesn't hit the secondary or the third effect of this primal fact. Well, I will come back to this right afterwards. I just want to finish this thing. Then she goes on and shows that because everything is mental, because we have to do with the mental and not with the material, it shows that everything that even which may be lost to consciousness, which has been in the subconscious, that it can be brought back to consciousness. The mind knows not of the emerald within its rock, and the sea is ignorant of the gems within its caverns, of the corals, of its sharp reefs, of the tall ships that float on its bosom, or of the bodies which lie buried in the sands. Yes, they are all there. See, she says, though we may not be conscious of all that which is subconsciously present within our mentality, it's still there. See, that's the point where we have to awake ourselves to see that there is a lot of error, a lot of mortal mind argument, a lot of mortal mind beliefs in our subconscious of which we are not conscious. They are there, though we don't know it. Though the sea knows nothing of the gems within its seas and of the ship that lies on the ground of the sea, though it knows not, they are there. And so in human consciousness, we have to see that that's what we are conscious of is not the whole content of mortal thought. That's only a part. And that's why if we don't always take the stand of the divine mind, of the divine consciousness, if that is not foremost in our consciousness, then the subconscious has a chance, certainly, to break through and to hit us. The true concept is never lost. The strong impressions produced on mortal mind by friendship and so on, they are all there to be perceived and to be reproduced. So we see how truth is here dealing really with the whole mortal consciousness. That mortal consciousness which contains and consists of not only of the conscious consciousness but of the subconscious consciousness and of memory and all that. And in order to show really how easily mentality mentality can substitute the physical senses and can substitute physical objects, she gives here this very easily, this last paragraph, memory may reproduce voices long ago silent. We have but to close the eyes and forms rise before us which are thousands of miles away or altogether gone from physical sight and sense. See, she wants to show that physical sight, she said before that which we can see what we believe and believe what we see. And that it's a matter of education if we can see or feel a thought. Well, here she shows that physical sight, with physical sight we can see a person, but that we also can see him with our mind. that we have just to close our eyes and form rise before us. And it's only a matter of education how exactly and how definitely and how clearly we can do that. Some we do it better, some less. And this not in dreamy sleep. In our daydreams we can recall what that for which the poet Tennyson expressed the heart's desire, the touch of a vanished hand. I think that's true. We sometimes just can recall, just feel the touch of a handshake of a dear person which we have known, though it may be years or 10 or 20 years ago. We can recall a laughter, a smile, a gentle gesture or anything just as vividly as it will be now, if it has been strong enough impressed on our human mind. The mind, small m, may even be cognizant of the presence of a present flavor and odor. When no viand touches the palate and no scent salutes the nostrils. She takes in this last paragraph all the five senses and shows that all the five senses which are called physical senses and which are called that they only work when there is a physical object and through physical operation, through a physical organism. But she says it's not true. That is only because through some thousand years we have been trained to do so. But that the mind can substitute the physical senses very easily. And that with the mind we can suddenly recall what somebody has said 20 years ago. That with the mind we can suddenly see a face or a situation or anything which has made a big impression on us. That suddenly we can smell a scent which perhaps in a certain instant has impressed us very much and so on. Easily can do that. And in dreams we certainly do. In dreams we certainly use all the mind as a substitute for all physical senses, where we see and hear and touch and smell and taste just as if we would use the five physical senses. And so she shows that everything is mental and that we have to do with the mental and not with the material. And that it is the mental, really, that is at the root of everything, and that through the mental can be made conscious. That's, I think she tries to show that just to break in our attitude and in our mentality the belief that only the physical senses, only through the physical senses we can use the senses. We can have the testimony of the senses. And she breaks that down and says, but if it is, it's only a matter of education, and then you would see that it isn't the senses that can produce a mental picture. Just as nobody today can explain how the five physical senses operate in the human body to produce the mental impression. How that transition from organism to a mental impression works. They only know that through some mysterious and unexplained way the barrier is from object, from the physical to the mental must be crossed in the human organism. Well, it's a belief like another belief. If we would culture ourselves like the spiritualists do, or like the mentalists do, or like the clairvoyants do, or like as they do it, well, we would be able to see more with our mind and would be independent of space and time. But let us be clear. Is that a name to be wished for? You see? That's the question which she only answers then in the next paragraph and shows, be aware, be careful. Even if the mind, small m, can replace the physical senses, well, we have not won very much. We have not won very much. We still are in the realm of mortal mind and not in the realm of divine mind. And so these mental systems like clairvoyancy and spiritualism and mortal mind reading and so on, they are very fascinating and interesting because it's unusual to replace the spiritual senses with mind, small m. But there is no savior in it. There's no savior in it. I remember a student who told me when she was about 30 years ago, a young mother, she was interested in spiritualism at that time. She didn't know Christian Science. And one day the little boy came to her and was rather, I think he was sick, or anyway, he needed comfort. And so the mother thought, well, how can I comfort that little boy? And so she thought of this. This little boy was living near a road where the motor car racers always tried out the new racing cars. And so this boy was just happy to see good racing cars, you know. And so when this boy was just a little boy, needed some comfort, his mother thought, well, let's ask the spirit to draw a nice motor car for you. And she thought that would comfort that boy. And so she was very perceptible to spiritualism, apparently, and the spirit drew a very nice, drew a picture. And when it was finished, the mother said to the child, well, I think we have been a bit cheated. That rather looked like a fish than a motor car. And about 3 or 4 days afterwards, in the newspapers appeared, for the first time, a picture of Campbell, you know, Campbell the motor racer, Campbell's Blue Bird, which he tried out at Salt Lake. And it was exactly that motor car, and it looked like a fish more than a motor car. See, it was taken from pictorial thought. Nobody in that country, in Europe, knew, have ever seen that motor car. But naturally, in pictorial thought, in America, it existed, and it was brought back through mediumship to be drawn on paper. Now, that mother is no more a spiritualist in spite of drawing nice motor car which nobody can draw. See, because there is no savior in it. What's the savior in it if I can draw a motor car which nobody has seen before? Is there a savior in it? Does that help me over the grave? It doesn't. It doesn't in the slightest. And so, but let's acknowledge, you see, that mortal mind really is that which sees and feels and hears and smells and tastes. See, that's a proposition of Christian Science. That's not only a proposition of spiritualism. That's a proposition of Christian Science. The mortal mind does see, hear, and feel, touch and smell. See. But the proposition of Christian Science is not that of spiritualism that we say and that is real. But we say, and that is unreal. It's just as another form of mortal mind as many other forms. So it isn't a help if I see through the mortal mind or through two holes in my head. That's no difference. What we have to see is the divine mind and to understand the divine mind. That's our seeing, the understanding of the divine mind. And that is a reality, and that is a savior, and that does help us over the grave. But spiritualism and mentalism and clairvoyancy and so on does not. That's why she says here that science enables us to read the human mind, but not as a clairvoyant. The clairvoyant, he sees what the mother or the aunt somewhere up north in Edinburgh is doing at this moment. What is the help for us if we know that? Does that help us over the grave? It's seeing mortal thought. We want to get out of mortal thought and not to multiply mortal thought. We want to get away from the plane of mortal thinking and not multiply the pictures of mortal thinking. So, And it shows, this is another point I want to, I told you I want to point out, that of, that it presents primal facts to mortal mind. You see, that science, that was the first sight, that science enables us to present primal facts of mortal mind. And what that means, I think I can best show you by reading from John Dolly's practice book, where he said, where he showed what he meant by it. You see, that he meant by it that if we have any situation, a case of sickness or so on, that we are not, that it is not enough to take that and just translate it into metaphysical terms, but that we should see behind that claim first and come to primal claims of mortal mind and then handle that. For, I read you from his books. He said, for instance, when you first start in the practice of Christian Science and you don't know any better, then if you have a case of indigestion, you probably know that there is only the divine digest of science, or that there is only the alchemy of spirit if it is a case of acidity, or that mind governs the action of the bowels if it is a case of constipation. See, that is not seeing the primal facts. It's taking digestion as a fact and try to translate it directly into metaphysical terms, to try to translate indigestion into the divine digest of science, for instance. But he says, but sooner or later you learn to use your spiritual sense. See, that sense which she described in principle as truth, to use your spiritual sense, to get at the governing error of the situation, at the governing error, at that error which is the cause, the root of that indigestion, which may have been many things. But you see what she says, science is that through principle as truth. You get the method of, she shows the method of how to discern the error which needs to be destroyed. And so it gives us that instrument into our hands which uncovers that which is unconscious, the subconscious. That patient only is conscious that he has digestion, for instance. And if we are not a very experienced and very spiritual in our practice, we take that conscious error and try to correct the conscious error through a conscious truth. But that is not going at the root of it. And this section of truth shows that through proper mind reading, we can go to the primal facts of mortal mind and present primal facts to mortal mind, and there, say, we may find a hate of somebody, or a worry, or an antagonism of somebody of which the patient is not even conscious of. Then we bring the unconscious from undercover and bring it up. And that is what Mr. Dolly understands and what Mrs. Eddy understands as real science healing.